everybody. Welcome, Steve, coming at you again with another part of the Author Spotlight series, this time with Carrie Gress of many books. But today we're talking about the Anti-Mary Exposed. Carrie, thank you for helping out, and welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
So Anti-Mary Exposed, I know you've been around the blogosphere, videosphere a few times on this, but explain, mm-hmm. what is this about? I know feminism's the main thing, right?
One way to look at it. Basically, the idea behind it is just to recognize what's happened to women over the last 50 years, I would say, in general. And, you know, the word anti-Mary is obviously, it's kind of a new term. In fact, we had to actually figure out how to spell it. We had a big debate about it because it's not really in the dictionary. But the idea behind it is that there has been a spirit like the Antichrist, but that it's one that has attacked women in particular. St. John talks about the Antichrist in terms of an individual, but he also talks about it as a spirit in one of his letters, and he describes it as something that's already in the world, going against Christ. And so the idea of the anti-Mary really is very similar, but instead of targeting people in a masculine way, the anti-Mary is targeting women in a very specifically feminine way. And so that's really what the book focuses on, is looking at what has happened to women over the last 50 years, and to really see how women haven't just gone from, you know, maybe moving away from the church in one way, but actually have moved in a direction that's diametrically opposed to who Our Lady is. So all the virtues that Our Lady embodies as the perfect model of Christianity, both men and women, particularly women, are exhibited through radical feminism and have been kind of, you know, baked into the cake from the very beginning. So that's sort of the short answer.
In 7 million words or less, can you explain?
Yeah.
You came out with Toxic Femininity. I think this book came out before mm-hmm. this whole toxic masculinity thing came out, right?
Well, actually, the toxic masculinity has been discussed, I would say, probably now for about 5 or 6 years. Okay. So it was definitely a play on that, because you poor men have been beat up sufficiently for decades, really. But in that term, very specifically. And so that was a word that Mallory Millett came up with. She was really instrumental in helping me research some of this book. Her sister Kate Millett was one of the early feminists who was very, very influential. And the great thing about it, though, is that using that word, Mallory came up with a title for her sister Kate's book about 50 years ago called Sexual Politics. And that was what got her on Time magazine, and really was what was established all of the women's studies programs in the United States. And so it was a great thing, I think, for Mallory to be able to come back and, you know, 50 years later, be able to help name my book. So it's one of those great behind the scenes stories.
So what made you come up with the book? What was the genesis of the idea to get you started mm-hmm. on it?
Well, when I wrote the book, The Marian Option, I have a chapter in it called Are We Living in the Age of Mary or of the Anti-Mary? And that was kind of really where it started, because I noticed that one of the things that you see historically is healthy generations recognize that their life is really there so that the future generations can live and survive. So it's sort of this, you know, play it forward sort of attitude. And our generation has done something of the opposite, where we see future generations as an inconvenience to us or something that are a burden to us. So it's sort of like the flow of life has gone backwards. So it's become a very narcissistic perspective. So I was sort of looking at that, but I also, while I was researching that book, I saw, you know, the most powerful women in American culture, and just it became resoundingly clear that there was nothing similar to their personalities and their virtues, or considered virtues, and who Our Lady is. And so that was just came very clear to me, that there's something anti-Marian going on here. So that's really where the title came from, and how it's, and actually, Tan loved the idea so much that they asked me to write the book on this topic. And of course, initially I thought, you know, is there really going to be enough information? What have I gotten myself into? And of course, over 2 years of research, I was just flooded with content that I could have added to the book. But, some of it is so depressing and, you know, it's awful that I tried to really limit how much I included in the book. I didn't want it to be the kind of book where you read the whole thing and you just go away, you know, feeling despair. But in fact, I wanted it to be the opposite, sort of really make my point in the first half, and then the second half be a place where women come away knowing what they, what it is that they should do, with a clear picture of hope and a direction to go in.
Yeah, because I mean, if you really wanted to get deep, you'd probably make Pilgrim's Empire that Cologne did look like a children's book.
Yeah, no, there's so much. It was really overwhelming, and I was just so grateful to not have to keep researching it once I was finished, because it's, you know, tracing down all those awful websites and books, and that kind of content is it's pretty heavy. So yeah, it was great to be finished with it. But it's sad that it's just what is in the air today. I think this is a way that women have been thought to think, and there really aren't alternative voices out there. If you look at everything from politics, Hollywood, book publishing, fashion design, magazines, you name it, these women are the ones that control the content that we get. Mm-hmm. So of course, you know, women without faith or without any other role models in their life to tell them differently are going to think that, you know, the best way to be a virtuous and healthy and happy woman is to follow what they say, which of course includes a lot of really unhappy making kinds of things, like abortion, like serial relationships that don't go anywhere, these kinds of realities, and very narcissistic kind of attitudes about what it means to be a woman. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's an important book, because we need to find ways to offer women a different perspective on what really will make them happy, instead of following along whatever that these women are telling them to do.
So when you were saying that you had to stop and you're not being despair or anything like that, what were, after you read stuff like this, what were something to get you back on the, you know, not that everything's awesome mindset, but
right.
off the edge?
Well, I think, you know, part of that was just looking at who Our Lady is. And, you know, it was a real challenge, because sometimes Our Lady can seem very saccharine or very one dimensional. You know, she's just the statue in a church. How do you relate to this person? And so it was challenging to sort of form her for the book in a way that people could relate to her. So I started looking more into, you know, what are the main things that women need that do make them happy. And of course, you know, the first one is to be known and loved. The second one is to do the good. And the third one is to be beautiful. And it was really interesting, because I'd finished up the book and I talked about how Mary fits all of these qualities, but in an ordered way. You know, she's not veering towards vanity. She's not veering towards doing good, but in the wrong way, because her will is perfectly formed to God's will. So she's always doing what really is defined as good. But she's also known and loved by God perfectly. So that's where her perfect happiness comes from. But the funny thing was, is that I, after I turned the book in, I was on a trip with my daughters, and someone had just said, "Oh, you should start watching Hallmark Channel. It's a great channel for girls." And you know, whether that's kind of debatable, but we started watching a couple of the movies. We watched two of them, and then we went to bed. And then one of my daughters got sick in the middle of the night, so I was up watching a third one. And I realized that the Hallmark has the exact recipe. This is exactly what happens in these movies, is there's a woman who gets to be known and loved. She's usually working on some kind of project, like saving a library or mm-hmm. something. And she's also beautiful in the film. So it was great to see that, you know, this is really a recipe that, you know, Hallmark's figured out. But it's much older than Hallmark, and it has a lot to do with the human nature of women and of women specifically. And I think that's an important thing, is to not ignore these things, how deeply embedded they are in the heart of women, because when we do that, that's when the distortions arise. Especially, you know, you can see this in vanity, or even in all of these women who were radical feminists. So many of them thought that they were doing good things. They thought they were being objectively good when they would have illegal abortions performed on themselves or their friends. They thought that they were doing good things when they said that women, female relationships were the height of creation and the best kinds of relationships to have. So it's interesting to see how these things play out. But I think that was really gave me a lot of hope, too, to sort of recognize that our human nature hasn't changed, but we need to help women understand how to work with that human nature in a virtuous way, instead of allowing the vices to really consume us.
Yeah, when you were saying that, I was just thinking of that phrase, corruptio optima pessima, the corruption of the best is the brings out the worst.
Right,
you were thinking, I mean, literally everything. I mean, I'm speaking on my name right there, voting from everything that's, you know, dividing the house, having the kids in daycare, you know, having somebody else raise them to, I mean, you don't think of the way we dress, the way they talk. I remember father talked about how women seem to cuss more than men when he's walking through the airports.
No, and I think that's right. Is there, you know, this is Satan's plan from the beginning. Why did he go for Eve first instead of Adam? Because he knows that women, you've got to get to them and you get everybody. And men don't like to fight with women. We know this even before the fall. Adam wasn't going to fight with Eve on this issue. And I think this has been one of the reasons why we haven't had much of a defense against this, because women have kind of gone along with the trends and or they've remained silent, not really knowing what to do. But at the same time, we sort of have had this hope that, okay, well, the priests and the hierarchy are going to work this out for us. Well, again, this, when you get to, a bishop gets so many complaints from women, this is really damaging to the relationship with men, with priests. They don't want to speak out about it. And then you also have, you know, all kinds of rhetoric that's been swirling around. It's really the same rhetoric, actually. That's one of the things that fascinates me about most about this is these groups are using the exact same rhetoric that they used in 1968. It hasn't changed because we haven't found a way to sort of push back on it and say, look, that's not even true. You know, especially if you look at what science has done, they're still saying, you know, her choice, her body, because they're not recognizing the actual life starts at conception science behind all of this. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of issues that that we've kind of swept under the table because we're uncomfortable speaking out against them or talking about them. And that's really what has allowed it to perpetuate. There's just been no defense against it. But we can really see that if we started getting some women who understood that the schizophrenic relationship we have with men is not producing great fruit. You know, we can't both simultaneously want them to change, but at the same time want to be exactly like them. So it's this odd reality. And I think that women are really starving for good content about what it means to be feminine. In fact, I recently published a short piece in the Magnificat, and I was amazed at, you know, it's 150 words, very short. And I was amazed at how many women came out of the woodwork and said, thank you so much for writing that. Because I talk specifically about the what women do. You know, we have this great capacity, you can see it in our bodies, this great capacity to carry things, to bring life to things. Even the way our arms are bent, you know, if you hold your arm out straight, a man's arm just folds out at, you know, straight out, whereas a woman's is bent, and that's so that she can cradle a child. But we also hold people in our hearts, in our prayers. Even the, you know, Our Lady, it says so many times in scripture, she pondered these things in her heart. This is one of the gifts that women have, is this capacity to hold people and to make their lives, to bring them to life and to make their lives better. And these are the kinds of things we just don't hear anything about. And that's, I think, part of the sad reality that we're living in, is people are starving for this kind of maternal love. And many of us who are mothers don't know how to give it. And those of us who are on the receiving end of it don't really even know what we're missing. We know there's something missing, but we can't really put our finger on it. So, yeah, it's a sad state of affairs when you don't have mothers. And that also translates into the reality that people can't approach Our Lady the way that they ought to, because they don't have a real icon on earth of what a mother should be. So it's very hard for them to really trust who Mary is when they've never seen what these great feminine virtues are.
I wish I got your guys that wrote you saying thank you so much. The ones, the feminist videos I get on my channel, we usually get 150 angry ones.
Yeah, right.
Male, 150 hate mails.
Yeah. No, there's plenty of hate out there. And I think that that's just the sad part, is just that it's become part of the movement of if you don't like something, you can just bully people into getting your way. And that's been really effective, rather than actually finding different ways to help women understand it's ultimately not going to make you happy. It's not going to help your family. It's not going to help the culture. It's just, you know, it's just going to perpetuate bitterness, which I think we're seeing all around us at this stage.
Yeah, there's always that gray line. I think it was a priest that brought it up about the Eve wasn't made for us to step on. Woman wasn't made under our foot to be stepped on. Wasn't used from our back to follow. Wasn't in front of us, our chest to to lead us, but it was under the rib cage of Adam, so our arms could go around her to protect
her side. Yeah. Right. Well, and that whole notion of being a helpmate and what that means in the original language of the Bible, scripturally, all of that, I think, has been very lost. Because what has also happened with radical feminism is you've got these sort of two pendulums. You have either their brand of feminism, which is, you know, the savvy, attractive woman who you see in magazines that's held up as kind of your ideal. You know, think of someone like Alyssa Milano or, you know, any movie starlet at this point. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, they've done an amazing job of portraying those of us who don't agree with them, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum, that we're very much doormats. We can't think for ourselves. We're sort of the Stepford Wife or the Handmaid's Tale. You know, we're all going to be wearing red bonnets and capes and, you know, all of that. So they've done a very good job with the optics of giving us icons in film and in literature and elsewhere for us to really think of ourselves this way. And I think that's the problem is, of course, the virtuous woman we know from Aristotle is going to be in the middle of that. She's not going to be a doormat. She's not going to be, she's not going to embrace these different poles of vices, but the virtue is always in the middle. And so I think that's one of the things that we really have to, another reason why we need to encourage women, because so many of us don't know how to, we're sort of invisible in the culture as a healthy Catholic woman. There's, you know, there's really no one that's more invisible in the culture than those of us who embrace the faith, who are educated, but that are open to life and, you know, who love our children, love our husbands, and are happy to work with them instead of try and compete with them. So that was the other thing I wanted to do with the book too, was just offer that as a model for people to start thinking differently about who we are as Christian women.
Yes, it's great that first thing I saw with the cover of the book is flowers under there. And I remember another priest talked about that. The women are the flowers, their beauty. They smell good. They look good. They're colorful. They're not guys. We're rough and jagged and, you know, be a woman. You don't want to be a guy.
Yeah, no, and that's really, again, why this confusion is so pernicious is because it has led us to think in so many ways, how can we be more like men? You know, we have to be assertive, you know, all of these different kinds of virtues that typically are very masculine. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we get rid of those things that are inherent in our character, but it does mean we have to recognize that this desire for beauty is something that's inborn. And why is it there? You know, even when I was researching the Marian option, I loved running across all of these different apparitions of Mary, mm-hmm. Because to a one, every person said she was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. Yeah. So Mary's beauty is important. So we know that it has a purpose. It's not just for vanity's sake, but her beauty is meant to be a icon or a way to see what heaven is like, to see what God's beauty is like. And so for women to really recognize that they have that capacity to live that virtuously, I don't think anybody talks about that at this stage. And so it was really great to sort of explore those aspects of it in the book and talk about why it is that beauty is so important. And we hear a lot, you know, of discussions about beauty is going to save the world and whatnot, but it's usually with reference to things like the liturgy, you know, church architecture, things like that, very material things, which are vitally important. But at the same time, it doesn't usually recommend that it's the beauty of women that can help save the world. And I think that was another aspect that I wanted to really point out was, you know, our beauty is a gift that we're meant to use well, and not for our own sakes or to manipulate other people. So it's another concept that we have to really look into and see why we've been gifted with this and why it's a desire of our heart, instead of ignoring it or thinking it's something that is taboo.
Fantastic. Well, that's Auntie Mary Exposed, Carrie Gress. She's got other books, like she mentioned, The Marian Option. We'll talk about that down the road. And I think you have a couple more other than that.
Yeah, I've got Marian Consecration for Children and then Theology of Home. Mm-hmm. And Theology of Home 2 is, we just are wrapping that up right now. That'll be out this fall. So that will be another great one to get.
Yes, ma'am. Well, we'll talk soon. And thank you for doing this.
Thanks so much, Steve.
God bless. Bye.